Hello, this is Barry Winbolt. Welcome to my podcast. I record the occasional interview with people who I think have something to say about resilience or some other aspect of personal psychology, something we can learn from. In this episode, I shall be talking to author Jeff Green, who turned a real-life tale of adventure, deceit and high drama into his first novel. In so doing, he transformed himself into a novelist, and another story unfolded. I've known Jeff for a number of years. He was kind enough to talk to me about what it took to become a writer, and also the painful process that it unleashed. We start with a passage from Paying for the Past, read by the author.
Paying for the Past tells a story of a parentless young man who puts his trust in a mesmerizing mentor and ends up in deep trouble. It is about how bishops, bankers, the wealthy and the ordinary man in the street will do extraordinary things, some to be totally ashamed of, to cover up wrongdoing. It is about loyalty, betrayal, friendship, and why good men do bad things, and then risk their lives trying to escape the consequences of their crimes.
Well, hello Jeff, good to see you again.
Thank you.
You've told me a little bit about Paying for the Past, and you've just outlined it in that little reading you did. I'm really fascinated because it seems to me that you've done a number of things in recent years. First of all, you lived through this very difficult time in your life, which spanned a good number of years, and I guess probably it wouldn't be far off the mark to say that the events plus the aftermath, it probably actively influenced your life, affected your life for something like 20 years.
Yes.
You lost friends, you were tested in terms of your personal loyalty, it brought your marriage to its knees and possibly led to the demise of your marriage. And out of it, you rose phoenix-like to produce this book many years later, but also in the meantime to reconstruct your life in what's always seemed to me to be a very successful way. So I think that the point I'm driving at from a human development perspective, if you like, or a psychological perspective, is how does somebody do that? And that's what I'd like to cover in this interview, some of the ideas about that. But for now, I just ask, seems to me, or comment on the fact that it seems to me you're playing several roles here. You were part of the history. You were in it. You were the lead or central character, perhaps not the lead character. You were also an observer, in that in writing your book, you've been able to stand back, which is a fairly uncommon characteristic, I think, for people who've been through highly emotional and charged affairs like that. So you're able to stand back and be very honest and truthful with yourself. I think that sings out from the pages of the book. But thirdly, you've also become, in a way, a forensic investigator or an academic. You're now researching. You had to research your book and the facts surrounding it, but you've also carried that over into your life, and you're now doing, you've met with people you hadn't met with for a long time, and you've investigated the veracity of things, you've gone back through newspaper archives. I'm interested to know whether you were conscious that you were taking different positions, or is it just something that happened to you?
I think it's just something that happened, and I think this came out of the fact that I wrote several drafts of Paying for the Past before I came to any what I call real writing, and the initial drafts were really accounts. They were, we did this and we did that. It was a sort of, it was literally an account of what happened rather than a story. I wanted to make it a story, and to do that I needed to go back and brush up on my writing and do stuff like that. So I did a little course with the London School of Journalism and moved on from that. But basically the whole thing came fairly naturally. It was driving itself almost. The story was in there waiting to get out. The facts were accumulating over the years because I obviously met people that were involved in the case and so on. I'd moved on in terms of my attachment to Miller, which was a big plus because then you could be brave enough to write the story as it was.
Okay, as it was, as it was, but seen from now. or seen from the time of writing,
yes.
which is a real skill. Miller, I should mention, perhaps was the lead character in this, really, wasn't he? He was the kind of the charismatic guru type figure who involved you in all this to start with. And I won't give more away now because I'd love people to read this book.
Okay.
What drew me to it, apart from the fact that I already knew you, was the idea that you could do the process you had done, which is the one we're talking about, which is that of somebody who experiences something and then somebody who also observes with such clarity. And then, as you say, you had to make it into a novel.
Yes. By this time, I'm a great reader anyway. I love to read novels. I read more novels than non-fiction, certainly. But I wanted to make the book a more readable account of what happened, a more readable tome, if you like. So I love the idea of using novel techniques to write the story. I wanted to put dialogue into the story. I wanted to put scenes that perhaps readers could be in themselves in terms of their imagination and so on. So this was kind of important to it. And this idea of the novel type approach to writing a non-fiction book was something that I really went with, and this hopefully was how it came out in the end.
Well, I found it a real page turner. It's rare that I can't wait to get back to a book the way I did with yours. Now, of course, because it happened in an area I live in, I was growing up myself at that time in the same area. I remember the incident in the newspapers vaguely. I didn't show any great interest at the time. So, of course, it had echoes for me. But it was that conversion to novel format, if you like, that probably contributed to that. Do you think you sacrificed anything? Or, if I put it more bluntly, is it still true?
Yes, it is. I don't think there's anything in the book that I've bent over. The dialogue is different because it's not verbatim, obviously. It's typical of what was being said at the time. And I did make notes in the journal through the time that I spent with Miller. So I did have an account of occasions and stuff that went on.
Well, so during that time you were actually keeping a journal?
I was keeping a journal. It was erratic, I have to say. There were pages that were, there were days that were missing. But where I could, I scribbled a paragraph or a sentence of what I thought was a very exciting time. And it's worth remembering too that I spent 11, 12 years with Miller, getting to know him, getting to know the way he worked, his kindness, his generosity, his ability to pull rabbits out of hats for almost everyone and everything. And this was it wasn't a brainwashing, but it was similar in a sense that I was so drawn to what he was doing. His healing practice, his running the nursing home, the way he helped everybody. This was a big magnet, not just for me, for everybody else. And this is why his crime was so successful in the early days.
Because he was able to, it was a smokescreen, effectively.
He was a smokescreen, and people, he was so easy to get on with, and he was so generous, and he was a magnet for all sorts of characters, you know, the good, the bad, and the ugly, if you like.
Mm-hmm. And well, of course, it goes without saying, you exactly. were clearly not the ugly. So.
And one of the interesting, this quote stays with me all my life, that when I first met Miller, and he would say, what do you want with your life? I said something like, well, I want to make my life comfortable. I want to have this and I want to have that. And he said, well, seeking comfort is not the best way to spend your life.
Well, that's a profound statement.
And that stayed with me forevermore, because I realised that outside your comfort zone is essential to grow and come good in your own life and other people's lives. Mm-hmm. It's impossible to do without it.
We should say, perhaps, for those who haven't read the book, although I hope they will, that Miller himself had considerable discomfort in his earlier life. He was, I believe, partly hemiplegic or partly incapacitated.
He was. The story of him becoming a cripple varies. Miller said that he fell downstairs when he was a very young person, was unable to go to school, was uneducated, didn't read. He hardly read a book. I think he read one book, which was White Fang by Jack London, which he quoted over and over again. That was his only read. So he was dyslexic, he was hemiplegic, he got out of a wheelchair when he was quite young and learned to walk again. And his story was that he found this inner strength. And it's not a religious thing, and probably a spiritual thing in a sense that we look at that now. But in a sense, he found something deep inside him that moved him out of that wheelchair, gave him strength, and gave him incredible courage and confidence. And this confidence, of course, was going to be his downfall in a way, because he was confident about making money, about meeting people, no matter where they were in the world, whether they were bishops, bankers, or...
And confident that he could continue to pull rabbits out of that.
Of course, and people were attracted to that because he was generous to them, both with his time, his healing, his... He was a giver, and and people took.
Yeah. You spoke about his strength, but what about your strength? Because I was very impressed, and that's why I was drawn to the idea of doing this interview, really, was when I was reading the accounts of what you went through physically and psychologically when you were helping these two men flee the law, in effect. That was emotionally arduous. It involved lying and concealment from even your nearest and dearest, which is not an easy thing to do, particularly for somebody who clearly has principles about these things. But also, just the sheer physical... I mean, I know you'd been a builder at that time and you had physical jobs and you're probably a young, fit man, but the physical endurance required to take that boat, to do all of the things in the conditions under which you were doing them, you must have drawn on tremendous resilience.
I think I did, and I always remember this story when we're learning about stuff, physiology and the way the body works and so on, that when you get an adrenaline rush that enables you to do extraordinary things, like you hear of women who lift a car to get the child out and so on, this adrenaline rush... It seemed to be with me. I seemed to be having this incredible energy. Don't ask me where it came from, whether it was something to do with the way Miller had influenced me and gave me strength in that way. But I was completely full of energy. I mean, it was almost like watching an adventure film from outside me. And okay. I was in an act with two other men, taking them to an island. But I was observing it outside myself, almost. It must be a character defect or something in me.
Well, I don't know about that, because what I'm hearing is dissociation. From a psychological perspective, I'm hearing dissociation. Yes. People often talk about this in moments of great valour and courage, or fear, trapped in burning buildings, this type of thing, or rising above events, and they say that time slows down. It's almost like I was an observer, I wasn't part of it. And perhaps there was something, I wouldn't necessarily jump to the conclusion that it's a defect, because certainly in this case it seems to have been adaptive. You couldn't have done it without that.
Sure.
Now, if we could move on a bit, so just to encapsulate that bit, you basically worked for these two men for something like 15 years, and at a certain point they had to flee the law. Although you didn't know that's what they were doing at the time, you thought you were just helping them get away to a quiet place, get their heads together, and 2 weeks later they'd be back. Yeah. And you then left them there, returned home as if nothing had happened, supposedly been on a business trip, present that story to colleagues, and with the exception of one or two who kind of looked sideways about that, you carried it off. But you then had to carry that off for months. I think it was 246 days or something before they were finally apprehended.
Yes.
What were you telling yourself at that time? I suppose that's what was motivating you to do that. The temptation to just say to people, look, after all these people are your friends and family, the temptation must have been tremendous, and yet you didn't.
Yes, I think what happened was, because it happened incrementally in a way, yes, they went on holiday for 2 weeks, but I knew they wouldn't be back for probably within a month or two. They had enough stores to keep them going for that long. The two-week holiday was merely a diversion so that they could get to where they were going, give some respite and so on, and delay what was happening. Now, in my mind, I thought, I know these guys. they're going to come back. They're not going to stay there for long. This is, you know, that they're worn out. They're making mistakes. They're making bad judgments. The fatigue that was going through them and the office and the surrounding people was fairly obvious. So I knew that was going to happen. But of course, when I got back, the 2 weeks were up. Then the size of the fraud started to come to light. I said, look, this, when I was going through my police interviews, the fraud squad interviewed me and so on. And we began to realise we're talking about thousands of agreements and hundreds of people. And that's when I had a heart sink moment about what I'd done. But I still thought at the back of my mind, okay, they had to do that. They're the guarantors of these agreements that people have signed. So if anything terrible happens and the banks start calling the debts in, the guarantors would be the ones that they'd go for.
And then gradually it became apparent that that wasn't going to happen and everything fell apart.
Sure.
And you were forced, and as you said, at one point you wound up having lost, in effect, your family. You were no longer married, you were living in a bedsit, I think you said, in Hove. Yep. But some way, I seem to remember that you said in the book that that was almost like a rebirth. It was kind of a cleansing. Did I remember that rightly?
Yes, you did. And this was absolutely true. Because, in a sense, the marriage that was not doing well was over. My kids were safe because my wife had a new partner and the kids moved in with them, so everything was secure in that sense. I felt like a free man, almost, although I wasn't. And the thing that started to happen then, I had to go to racing circuits and tell drivers that I didn't have any money to present them, prize money to present them with and so on, which were pretty awful moments. But these were arranged events, so I had to go and face those.
Excuse me, you say you had to go and face them. That was a choice, nevertheless,
yes.
Because some people wouldn't have done.
No, that's true.
By now, this was a public scandal almost.
Yes, that's right.
And yet you chose to go back and face hostile fire.
Yes.
What was behind that?
Well, I think throughout my life I try and be, although it may not seem it, considering the path I took in the fraud, I do try to be straightforward and honest. And I think no matter how bad things get, you have to face your commitments. Mm-hmm. Or you have to deal with them in some way. And you have to deal with them in such a way that you can say, well, I couldn't solve the problem, but I did what I could to face it. And one night, Miller, I picked up the phone, and it was Miller's voice on the other end. This was months into after they've disappeared. And he said, could you send us some money? And I knew then he was ashore. He gave me the address of where they were staying. I realised then that they weren't coming back. They must have known how broke we were or what would happen. Perhaps they didn't, I don't know. So at that point I thought, I'm going to have to give them up. You know, I can no longer hold on to...
Can I just get the chronology right here and make one comment? You mentioned... You realised they were ashore.
Yeah.
We should perhaps say at this time that, to clarify things for people listening to this, that,
sure.
That actually they've been across a bit of water.
Yes,
they,
yes.
Where they were. And you took that call actually before you were in your bed set. You took that call while you were still in the marital home.
Yes, really the move to the bed set was almost at the time I gave them up, which was 10 months later, that kind of timing.
So you've been through 10 months of hopefully something which hopefully none of us would ever have to live through. I mean, regardless of the causes, the consequences, the motivations, nevertheless, the psychological turmoil you must have been in during that time, it doesn't seem as if you experienced it as a daily psychological turmoil, but what it did seem to me was that... You must be pretty robust to have done that,
sure.
And that's what fascinated me in the book, that you managed to keep on getting up and going back.
Sure.
And you've explained how that was part of who you are,
what
you were at that time, still are. And then you were in the bed set, you changed your life in effect, clean slate, start again. By now it was public, and you started to rebuild your life.
Yeah.
Was that a conscious decision, or was it something that just... kind of
yes, because I think when you live on your own in perhaps a single room more or less, you do reflect a lot on what's happened and what you're doing, and you realise that there are things that you want to make your life different, and one of them was to, obviously, to move on. This was the time I met Carol, my present wife, so we both decided that we would make big changes in our lives, and we both went to... I had to go back to school and do my own A-levels because I left school at 14, so I had no education, really, in that sense. And Carol had her A-levels, but we went back to do our courses. Carol did an acupuncture course, and I became an osteopath and did a five-year course, which ended in a Bachelor of Science degree. So in amongst that, I went back to the building trade and helped finance my way through.
So you supported yourself by...
Supported myself.
By doing what you've done before.
I'm afraid of exposing yourself. Said, if you're not going to show what was in your heart or your life in real terms, don't bother to write the book, because people won't believe it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I tried to do. So when I started writing it from the inside, which I wrote very, very quickly, probably 80 days I wrote that draft, while I was working as well, but it was completely different from the accounts that I'd written. It was pulled out from the inside outward, which was exhausting. It was a little bit painful, sometimes very painful, exhausting, and it was probably the first time where I got close to feeling depressed and anxious in a way that I'd never felt before.
So was that the novel writing process, or did something happen after that?
That was a novel writing process. When I did the first drafts of this, which were simply accounts, and all I was doing was adding more facts. I wasn't telling a story particularly. I wasn't adding dialogue. Nobody knew what Miller sounded like or what he looked like particularly. But there was a lot of doing this and doing that, and there were a lot of exciting things in there that weren't made exciting by the writing.
While you're an observer, to some extent you were safer.
Yes.
And played it safe, and it read safely.
Yes.
And then when you actually got in touch with the material and the experience and wrote your story,
yes,
in the way that people would want to read it,
yes,
that was actually a much more demanding, personally demanding process for you.
Yes.
And there's a question in the back of my mind, I can't quite frame it, but what interests me here is the parallel with something like narrative therapy, where we may not be able to change our lives, but we can change the story. You could have told your story in several different ways. You could have written it, for example, as a victim. You could have written it as a hero. What it seems to me you did was you kept elements of the report in. You kept the veracity of the report, but you brought you and you brought authentic voice on the part of your characters in, so that it was believable as a story.
Yeah, sure.
I'm not judging it as a literary work,
sure.
I'm judging it as something that I read and got drawn into.
Sure.
Therefore, if you could have written it from 3 or 4 different, 10 different perspectives, that suggests that each perspective would be different. If you'd written it as a victim, it would have been a different story,
sure,
for example. What I'm saying is the truth that you presented, verifiable, authenticated fact, which is embellished a little by literary talent, if you like, or by writing license. We can also do that with our lives. For example, somebody can say, God, I've had a terrible week, blah, 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 and somebody else will reframe that and say, well, yeah, but look at all the challenges you've overcome. And that's a very simple example, but in a big sense, that's what you've done.
Yes.
And you've chosen to use that 20-something year period of your life, 25-year period of your life, as a tremendous learning experience, and continue to build on it. Other people might not have done that. Is there anything we can learn from this for other people who might go through hard times?
One of the things I can say is that I have never felt that anything that's happened in my life has given me a hard time. I never feel that life has been harsh to me. Even though I've been through some harsh, what people would call some harsh times, some difficult times, you know, mother and father died at a young age, father was an alcoholic, all these kind of things. And they just seemed like things that I accepted as being normal. And I think this is one of the things, and I don't know why it drives me on, that you accept everything, that when things go wrong or things go well and so on, it just seems part of a continuum that everybody gets. And we do meet people that, you know, worry about pain or what's happened to them, or and I don't understand the amount of energy they give to those thoughts, because I think it's almost living your life kind of day by day and seeing these interruptions in your life, whether they be good or bad, as something that, come and go, and it's inevitable right through your life. So there's some kind of perspective, and I don't know why I have it or I've got it. It's not a learned thing, as far as I can tell. I tend to be to quite easily see the good of things. I forgive easily. I don't fall out with people. If I don't like people, I don't spend time with them, but I don't fall out with them. And I think I'm quite good at being honest with myself about what I feel about different people and why I don't connect socially just for the sake of being social. I will connect with people I like and make time for people I like, and I won't be unkind to anybody or anything. But so, in other words, there's an order in my life that suits me very well. And a bit like the quote I said earlier about being in the comfort zone, I never try and make my life comfortable. I never rule anything out or rule anything in necessarily. And I do put myself under a certain amount of stress. But I know from my past that unless you face tough decisions and do tough things and face tough things, that your life doesn't really become that fruitful.
Okay, so very wise words, and I don't think there's a more fitting close to this interview, really, or this discussion. I would say that we've touched on a lot of bits and pieces about the book, and I hope it's served to interest people enough to go out and get it. I'm not saying that to plug the book necessarily. I'm saying it because I think the book is a chronicle of events which is uplifting, and which shows us all that adversity doesn't have to be a problem. And I think you've just reaffirmed that with your closing words. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Barry, very much.